I'm Dr. Tina Kayser, and as Leah likes to say, I'm the sciencey one.
And I'm Dr. Leah Sherman, and I'm the cancer insider.
And we're two naturopathic doctors who practice integrative cancer care.
But we're not your doctors.
This is for education, entertainment, and informational purposes only.
Do not apply any of this information without first speaking to your doctor.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast by the hosts and their guests are solely their own.
Welcome to the Cancer Pod. Hello, Tina.
Hey, Leah. We're back.
Yeah. So our episode ran a little long, so we decided to split it in two.
Yes. So what this is going to be is part two.
Yeah. We'll just pick up where we left off, and we're actually going to record a little bit more that is pertaining to what we talked about in the first episode.
Yeah. So in the first episode, you had gotten your MRI, and now we will conclude that with where you're at today.
Well, we're not concluding it because we still don't know stuff. So we're going to do another chapter.
Yeah. It's like real life.
It is real life. It's my life. Okay. So let's get back to what we were talking about before, after I talked about having had neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and then we'll be back at the end to pick up.
Sounds good. Neoadjuvant means that the chemo is done before the surgery, and it is usually to shrink the tumor so that surgery is more successful. And it's always done in things like triple negative breast cancer that generally always undergoes neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Your type was estrogen receptor positive.
Mm-hmm.
Progesterone receptor?
Positive.
Positive.
HER2 negative.
HER2 negative. So in the general sense, the PR, progesterone receptor positive, alongside ER positive, is supposed to be where tamoxifen does its best kind of risk reduction in that scenario, more so than ER positive, PR negative.
Yeah, mine, from what I recall, it was pretty strongly positive on both of those. And it was grade 3.
Did you get an Oncotype DX done?
I don't think I did. My KI 67 was like 30 something. Mm-hmm. So, I mean.
Yeah. And you know, in the newest, I think it was, I don't know the year, somewhere in the last few years, they have redone the staging system for breast cancer to include the grade. So they're looking at the grade of the tumor on the pathology report. They're looking at that now as part of the prognostic indicators. So that wasn't done. When you were diagnosed, they didn't use that as part of the staging. It was there on the path report, but they didn't use it in a clinical sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, it makes it sound like I was diagnosed so long ago. And I guess it kind of was in a way, but not really. It's just weird.
8 years? 8 years ago?
8 years.
And you're still on an anti-estrogen agent?
I'm still on tamoxifen. Yeah, there was talk about me switching to an aromatase inhibitor. So I had two injections of Gosserilin because 2 weeks into my chemo, I had some spotting and my oncologist was like, oh no. I mean, these are not his words. My oncologist did not talk like this. This is my portraying my oncologist. He basically was like, oh no, we're shutting this down. My words, not his. And so I remember just crying. I did not want Gosserilin. I always talk about like, oh, I didn't cry through treatment. I had my moments, and that was one of them. I did not want that. And he talked statistics, and I'm sitting there thinking like, I am so much more than a statistic. I really respected my oncologist. I still respect him. I think he's just freaking brilliant and took great care of me. But that was something that I was like, I wish I advocated for myself a little stronger. So that immediately put me into menopause. So my second oncologist, after he left to go to MD Anderson, my new oncologist, Dr. Lynch, had talked to me about like, oh, well, you know, we've looked at your hormones and you're in menopause, like you're postmenopausal. So let's consider an aromatase inhibitor. And we had done a DEXA initially at diagnosis. And so it had been 2 years. And so we repeated the DEXA and I had osteopenia.
And the DEXA scan is a bone density scan.
Yeah. So people say bone scan, but it's not a bone scan. It's not looking for cancer. It's looking at your bone density. So I had osteopenia, and I actually had already broken a bone in my foot. I fell off a bicycle and broke my foot. So I was like, I don't want osteoporosis. I don't want to do the aromatase inhibitor. I could have done, you know, some sort of medication to support my bones that can potentially reduce your risk of having cancer appearing in your bones. And I just, I had had such weird reactions to my chemotherapy, to my surgery. Like I had such weird reactions. I was like, I really don't want to do more medications. Can I please stay on the tamoxifen? And she's like, you know, it's your choice. It's fine. And then they, was it like last year, maybe the year before, they ran that test. What's that test where they look to see the benefit?
Breast cancer index?
Yeah, they did that. And it showed that there was no additional benefit staying on the tamoxifen, but I use vaginal estriol cream, and you can't use that unless you're on tamoxifen. So, and that takes me into a whole different side effect where I actually had vaginal tears.
Oh, okay.
And had it repaired, and, you know, had surgery and had it repaired, and then a stitch popped. And so it never healed. And I would continue to have like spotting from that tear. And started using, it was estradiol at the time. And then I switched it to estriol to help heal. Mm-hmm. And I, yeah, my gynecologist, who's aware of my history, you know, she wrote me a prescription for the estriol later. But yeah, so I'm staying on the tamoxifen. I guess I'll do 10 years and then see what happens.
Yeah, that breast cancer index is really interesting. I find that it's underutilized. I don't have a lot of docs ordering it. It's literally just called that. We're not making up that name. Breast cancer index is a test of the actual tissue that was taken out.
Yep.
That looks at whether or not continuing tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor should be beneficial or not, given the parameters that they look at in the pathology of the original tissue.
But we've talked about this before, and they look at the benefit for like a really short time period, like 5 years or something. Mm-hmm. It's really obnoxious where you're just like, well, I've done 5 years. Thanks. I'm still here. Got it. You know, so it is, I don't know. I mean, my oncologist had brought it up and was like, well, we could do the breast cancer index and see, you know, if it's appropriate. And so, yeah, I was able to have that done. I don't think my insurance covered it. I think we paid upfront for it. So that's something else for people to consider. But I mean, my goal was to increase my physical exercise because exercise really has been shown to reduce your risk of recurrence of breast cancer. And I'm human. I go through phases of like, yeah, I'm exercising. And then I'm like, oh, I don't want to exercise. So, so I have my tamoxifen backup.
So, and the exercise is also helpful for your bones.
Yes.
I mean, that's the one
absolutely
thing that's very reliable because especially if you build muscle mass, because breaking down the biology to the simplest form, the compounds your body makes to build muscle are the same or similar compounds that it makes to build bone. So you literally can't build muscle without building bone. It doesn't happen, which makes sense, right? Because you wouldn't want your giant bicep hanging off a little skinny bone underneath. That wouldn't work. You'd snap the bone with a big muscle. So you have to build bone when you build muscle, big Popeye forearms. All right. So I'm thinking a question I often ask when people are telling their story, and that is because we want to learn from you, right? Mm-hmm. We want people to learn not only from your successes, but also from your mistakes. And so in that sense, if you could go back and do it all over again, what would you do differently? Anything?
I would exercise.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've thought of that. I mean, and I don't think of it like, oh, I want to do this again, but no, I would have exercised. Absolutely. Weights, exercise. Did I belong to a gym then? Maybe I joined afterwards. But I mean, there was no COVID, so I could have worn a mask anyways and gone to the gym. But yeah, I absolutely 200% would have done weight-bearing exercises. Totally. And this is before learning the benefits of exercise during cancer treatment. Mm-hmm. My oncologist, who is visionary. I mean, he had a phase one trial going on while I was getting treated, looking at fasting prior to, during, and after chemotherapy in women with early stage breast cancer. I fasted, but I wasn't part of the trial because I did have broth, but still, like, and he was looking at all of these labs and stuff. So in that way, he was very forward thinking. I have posted that before, on commented on people's Instagram pages, and have been attacked for it, saying like, oh, I would get another oncologist. You know what? My oncologist, I am so grateful that he was my oncologist when I was diagnosed. He also had really encouraged exercise. This is back in 2014. This wasn't being talked about. One of the other dietitians at the cancer center asked me one day, are you exercising? And I'm like, I move around at work. And she goes, because I was being treated on a different floor for the first infusion was in the main infusion room. And then because I felt weird, like dragging my pole in front of my patients to go to the bathroom and whatnot, they put me on the research floor that was less busy and a little bit more private. One of the dietitians was like, you need to be exercising while you're getting your infusion. Mm-hmm. 2014, y'all. Mm-hmm. Ahead of her time. So yeah, I don't know where I was going with that, but the two people, you know, who were part of my team, I think even my ND, like they were all telling me to exercise. I was so freaking tired. I knew that exercise would help me with my fatigue, but there was no way I was going to exercise during my infusion, because the minute they gave me that IV Benadryl, I was out. I mean, I was, forget it. I was gone. Mm-hmm. I barely remember leaving the cancer center. I didn't drive, y'all. Pause. As an aside, I had rides. But yeah, so not that I ever want to do this ever again, but if I do have patients of mine who are listening to this, you now know why I push exercise as hard as I do. Mm-hmm. I'm even working with the cancer center and heart and vascular, that's part of the hospital right now, working on a program for patients at the cancer center to exercise during their treatment. So, I mean, this is my soapbox. Uh-huh. That's the one thing that I mean, because my diet, I ate what I wanted. What I wanted was protein, veggies, and fruit. Mm-hmm. My husband would cook when my mom wasn't around, and he would cook some sort of meat product, and I would come home and make the vegetable, you know, the vegetable side of it. But that's what I ate. I didn't crave sweets. I remember on my birthday, I had a glass of wine, a glass of champagne. I think I must have had some sort of gluten-free chocolate, you know, chocolate cake or something. I must have had something like that. But I really didn't crave sweets. Mm-hmm. I don't think I lost weight from fasting. I think I stayed about the same. It wasn't until I went into menopause and started on all the tamoxifen and everything that I gained weight. But
so you're fasting around the chemo. How did you fast around the chemo infusion?
24 hours before.
Okay.
Day of, during my infusion, I would have broth, either chicken bone broth that they had in the cafeteria or a vegetable broth. I preferred the chicken because it just tasted better. Mm-hmm. And then I think I've talked about this. I made Rebecca Katz's magic mineral broth, mm-hmm. and I threw bones in it. So it was a veggie mineral bone broth. And that's what I had. That was the last thing I had before I fasted. That's what I had if I didn't have what was at the cancer center for broth during my infusion. And then that was what I had to break my fast.
Okay. Okay.
So it was 24 hours before, 24 hours after. My first infusion, because I had fasted to get my port placed, that was like a 60-something hour. That was crazy. That was like a ridiculous, because I had to fast before my surgery. Mm-hmm. And then I had to fast 24 hours before my chemo. Yeah, no, that was like the never ending fast, but I was fine. I never felt hungry. I stayed hydrated. I did not experience any nausea or vomiting. Definitely experienced fatigue, definitely experienced neuropathy, but everything else, it was kind of easy. And I think it was easier to do it then in the moment, because I was in that state of, I need to do everything possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If you tried to get me to fast for 24 hours now, I'd be a big whiny baby. I'd be like, hell no.
All right. In your defense, you do Prolon.
And I'm a big whiny baby. I've recorded these when I'm like breaking my Prolon fast or whatever. Like, no, you know, I've done this actually during Prolon.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't call you a whiny baby, because when you don't eat much for 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, and I know Prolon, it's a fasting mimicking diet, and we'll put links to that down below. And we'll also link to the idea of fasting in general around chemo. So just so the listeners are aware.
I've got something that my former oncologist wrote too, so we can link to that. I think we've done that before too.
Okay. So just, do you do Prolon every month?
No, I don't do it every month. I was doing it every other month.
Okay.
And you know, when I first did Prolon, I was hungry. When I do it now, I've been doing it since, 2019? So 3 years-ish? Almost 4? I don't know. I can't count. I don't do math. I'm not hungry. I just miss food. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sitting there going like, oh, I'm starving. I'm just like by day 4, I'm reading recipe books or watching like food channels, you know, like I want to eat. And it's not like mm-hmm. I'm sitting there like, oh, I need something. It's just, I miss it. I miss flavors and textures and all of that kind of stuff.
The joy.
I miss the pleasure. I am very much I love eating. I love cooking. Yeah. I love eating. Now we're sounding like a Prolon ad. They now have a 1-day reset.
Oh.
And I got one and I did it. And I still got that whole like, I want my food, but it was so much easier. So I think what I'm going to do, instead of doing it every other month, the whole kit, the whole 5 days, I think I'm going to do a kit and then a couple months of like the reset and then go to the kit again. Like I'm spreading it out because it's really like,
yeah,
I get tired of soup. I mean, it's actually like, it's decent, but I get tired of it.
Yeah. And do you, on top of this, do you do the time restricted eating?
I was doing it. We've talked about this before where my schedule now doesn't necessarily lean towards me being able to do it because I don't want to feel like I get to work and I eat, but then I start seeing patients if I eat like at 8 o'clock at night, which I hate to do, or if I finish eating at 8, then I can't eat until 9 because I do a 13-hour fasting period because that's what works best with me. And it's really kind of the easiest one to. And that's also what the research is like, 13 hours, you're good. I'm like, woohoo. So I try to do it, but I don't know. It doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
So I try to do it a few days a week.
Okay. So from, let's say you finish eating at 6 at night, you don't eat until 7 the next morning. Mm-hmm. That would be considered a 13-hour fast. The data we're talking about, it's an observational study. There's actually 2 out there, 2 papers. But basically, women who did that had less recurrence of their breast cancer. This caveat to this is we don't know cause and effect. We just know women who were doing that had less breast cancer recurrence. Is this because they had better blood sugar? Is it because they slept better? Is it because of other reasons? We don't know. But time-restricted eating seems like something we should be doing in general. 13 hours sounds totally like enough. They're looking at even going 16 hours for people with blood sugar issues like prediabetes and even type 2 diabetes and seeing an improvement in the underlying physiology of the condition, which is the fascinating part, because we have these genes in our cells called clock genes. And it's fascinating. They are programmed to turn on and off over the 24-hour cycles, various genes. And these clock genes are implicated in some cancers, including breast cancer. So the better we can sync ourselves with the feeding and fasting, the sleep, the wake, the 24-hour cycle that is the rhythm of a human body, the better our health will be overall. And possibly it might reduce our risk of various conditions, including cancers.
Well, I try to rein my female patients in if they try to do over 16 hours, because there's a lot of stuff where it's like, do 18 hours, do 24 hours. And that can lead to issues that I've seen mostly in women where they start to retain abdominal fat. I try to stick with the 13 hours because it is doable. Sometimes, you know, I get busy at work, whatever, and I will do, 16 hours unintentionally. I think a really important thing, at least for me, and it's one thing that I have picked up from Prolon, is making sure that there is like at least a 3-hour time period between eating, because I am one who will just graze all day and I have digestive issues. I think that were just really exacerbated with my treatment. So I digest food better. I have less bloating and other, you know, less reflux if I give myself 3 to 4 hours between my meals. And that is something that Prolon, the way that I do it, I set it up so that I do have 3 hours in between mostly because I'm trying to make sure that I'm not waiting too long to eat because you have such little food in that program. But yeah, that to me is a big part of my regimen, is not mm-hmm. to do the constant grazing.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Which, you know, and this is as a breast cancer survivor. I mean, if somebody is going through treatment right now, you know, follow what your dietitian says. If your dietitian says have small meals every couple hours, like go for that. I mean, that's what you should be doing. This is me where I'm at 8 years out, working on my other issues health-wise. And I found that definitely having that gap helps.
Yeah. And when you mentioned the idea of women gaining abdominal fat, visceral fat, maybe even more fat deposit in their liver, I would assume, if there's too much fasting going on, that's an interesting idea. Because if you fast, your body needs to get ready for the next fast. So in some ways, just the time-restricted eating makes a lot of sense because your body can rely that there will be food coming. You don't go days without it. There's a little trigger in the body that says it's coming. You don't have to go socking it away in fat stores because you're going to be without calories for days at a time. So it's interesting that you have that observation because it makes physiological sense that too much fasting can lead to a conservation of energy where the calories are literally go into storage because your body's expecting you to fast again.
Yeah. So, and I've said that with patients who are in survivorship and they tell me that they're doing, you know, time-restricted eating and they lost a lot of weight initially and then it stopped and it seems to be really hard to come off their belly. And I'm like, well, why don't we just try cutting back a little bit? So.
Yeah. Somebody just explained to me that when bears eat all those berries in the fall before hibernation, I didn't realize this, but they're giving themselves a fatty liver on purpose with all the sugar and the fruit and the berries and the excess calories. They get a fatty liver so that when they go to sleep, all the fats in their liver then get mobilized for their energy while they're sleeping, while they're hibernating.
It just made me think about that joke about bear poop with berries and the bells. Do you know that joke?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, it's a really good joke, but I can't remember it, but it's funny. I might just record it separately and stick it at the end of the episode for everybody to hear. It's a really good joke. Anyways, I think we've talked a lot about a lot of different things. I didn't go too deep into liver cancer, but I do want people to be aware because breast cancer does get a lot of attention in October, but it is also Liver Cancer Awareness Month. And yeah. All cancer is tough. And it was a lot harder for me to watch my father go through treatment for liver cancer than it was for me to go through treatment for breast cancer. But then again, it was also really hard for me to go take care of my mom and watch her go through treatment for ovarian cancer. So I guess in my case, it's just easier for me to go through it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Cancer sucks.
Cancer does suck, and it sucks from both sides. And mm-hmm. and I can see how your own experience is something you had some control over, too. It's hard to see our loved ones go through it.
Yeah.
The sense of lack of control or helplessness even is rough.
All right, Tina, we are back, fast forwarding a couple of weeks from when we first recorded this.
Yep.
Where we last left off, I had just come back from getting an MRI and we didn't have any results or anything from that. It was just, I was feeling something weird in my left implant. And so my med onc ordered an MRI. And so I had that done up here and it came back with something suspicious in the right breast, which is actually there as opposed to just an implant on the other side. So I got a biopsy today mm-hmm. and I will be getting the result sometime tomorrow, maybe, or at least my med onc will get the result tomorrow and then she'll have to call me. So yeah. Talk about the lack of control, the sense of lack of control. Hello.
Right.
Surprise. Yeah, it's the October surprise. Isn't that what they all talk about with politics? The October surprise.
Yeah, this is a whole nother version. And yeah, so this is part one and two. So when we started part one, you had the MRI waiting for that result.
Right.
And now we're waiting for the result of the biopsy itself. So it's another waiting period.
Yeah. So I'm sure there'll be a part 3, and maybe it'll just be like a little 5-minute episode where we're just like, oh, hey, I'm back. All's good. Bye. Later. Out. On that yes. note.
Yeah. You hope for one of those words in medicine that you hear, like, unremarkable.
Yeah. So do you have to say, and it's not like I haven't experienced scanxiety or being skanxious, which is the word I like. It's mm-hmm. not like I haven't experienced that before, but I have to say that this truly was, it was major. It was just because it wasn't as fast as if when I was living in Arizona and I could just get everything done right away. I now mm-hmm. am at a community cancer center that things move fast, but not to the speed at which I am accustomed. So it's been hard.
Yeah, that waiting time between scans, just finding results. Yeah, where you were before was a private hospital and they were a destination hospital too. So people were coming in. So their systems were set up for
being fast.
To be convenient, yeah, to people who are traveling from afar to get there.
Right.
And they took very good insurance, you know, at that place. And so generally speaking, they had just better care all around. And I hate to say it, but it came down to money flow. I mean,
but it still is fast. That's the thing. It's no longer in that model because of all of the changes in healthcare, but you still get results fast. Anyways. So yeah, it's a little different down there, but a lot of it is the same. Plus the fact that, I don't know, it just, the whole thing just, it sucks. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's that unknown. Because mm-hmm. I think I even was texting someone. Was it you or someone who I was texting someone saying I was freaking out because I hadn't heard back about mm-hmm. the MRI. And I was trying to talk myself down because I didn't have access to a portal because it wasn't through my cancer center and I don't have a portal here. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't read the MRI and I wasn't hearing back. And it was, you know, freaking me out because the longer you don't hear back, the more that your imagination goes and the more you think that this is bad news. Mm-hmm. And then the very next day, I got a call from the nurse saying, oh yeah, we need to get a second look ultrasound and possibly a biopsy. And so then I called to schedule that. And because the interventional radiologists don't work all the time, the soonest available appointment was 2 weeks out. So actually, it's been longer since we recorded. But yeah, I've been like going crazy.
Yeah.
Losing my mind. And I feel better today, now that the biopsy is done, and then knowing that in a day or two, I'll have the results. Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm going to read a comment.
Like a listener comment?
It's a listener comment that was on, it was on Apple Podcasts. And if our listeners leave comments, maybe I'll read them too.
Okay.
So this is a really nice one. It's from AJ Hay, and it says, one of the best. This is a must listen to podcast to get valuable medical and lifestyle information for anyone touched by cancer. Fun way to learn about the functional approach. No voodoo, but sensible. Highly recommend.
Wow. And AJ's not, it isn't related to either of us, right?
I don't know who, it could be, but I don't know who it is. I don't think so. It's not one of my parents. But no, I like that. Not voodoo.
That's awesome.
Oh, that's going to be a t-shirt.
It's not voodoo?
Not voodoo. Could be if you want it to be, but it's not.
That's great. We should read more comments. Apple seems to be the place that most people leave reviews. There's a lot of small indie players out there too. Directories, podcast directories. I'm enjoying one now called Overcast.
I haven't looked to see if other places have reviews. I thought you could just do it on like on the majors.
You're right. The majors are where they have the stars and the actual comment area. But there's other directories and indie podcast players out there that are kind of nice to hear it on too. So I encourage people to check out some lesser podcast players, mostly because I think that we are an indie podcast. We are not NPR. We are not the BBC.
We're not TED Talk.
We're that theater down the alley with the good play that...
We're off Broadway.
We're way off Broadway.
So far off Broadway. Okay.
Apparently.
We got stuff coming in season two. We're figuring it out. So stick around. Follow us on the social media. You know what to do. On that note, I'm Dr. Leah Sherman.
And I'm Dr. Tina Kayser.
And this is The Cancer Pod.
Until next time.
Thanks for listening to The Cancer Pod. Remember to subscribe, review, and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media for updates. And as always, this is not medical advice. These are our opinions. Talk to your doctor before changing anything related to your treatment plan. The Cancer Pod is hosted by me, Dr. Leah Sherman, and by Dr. Tina Kayser. Music is by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.
Let's talk about me, baby. Park rangers are advising hikers and campers in national parks to be alert for bears and take extra precautions to avoid encounters. They advise park visitors to wear little bells on their clothes so they make noise when hiking. The bell noise allows bears to hear them coming from a distance so they won't be startled by a hiker accidentally sneaking up on them, which might cause the bear to charge. Visitors are told that they should also carry pepper spray, just in case they encounter a bear. Spraying the pepper into the air will irritate the bear's sensitive nose and it'll run away. It's also a good idea to keep an eye out for fresh bear droppings so you have an idea if bears are even in the area. People should be able to recognize the difference between black bear and grizzly bear scat. Black bear droppings are smaller and often contain berries, leaves, and possibly bits of fur. Grizzly bear droppings tend to contain small bells and smell of pepper.